Chapter 2, Blacks in Early Miami, 1896 to 1926. The great freeze which struck the southeastern United States in the winter of 1894-95 propelled ruined farmers and farm workers, white and black, to settle in warmer South Florida. Ultimately, this led to the arrival of the Florida East Coast Railroad at Biscayne Bay in 1896 and the founding of the city of Miami in that year. The black section of the new city was called Colored Town, and although other black communities developed in Coconut Grove and South Dade, it was Colored Town that became the focus of black life in Dade County. An informal color line restricted Miami blacks to living only in Colored Town, and as a result, a healthy and viable black business and professional community evolved to meet black needs. Blacks from the Bahamas continued to arrive in South Florida, and by the turn of the century, a considerable percentage of the city's black population was from the islands. Their presence influenced many aspects of the cultural and religious life of the community. The railroad comes to Biscayne Bay, 1896. Only the southern tip of Florida was spared by the Great Freeze. Sensing an opportunity to build the city she had envisioned, Julia Tuller wrote to Flagler. Tuller promised to give him half of her 640 acres for building a new city if he would bring the railroad to Biscayne Bay. William Brickell, who owned thousands of acres south of the Miami River, also agreed to donate half of his land to the new city. A widely believed story holds that Tuller convinced Flagler by sending him an orange blossom from her grove after the Great Freeze. However, it is contradicted somewhat by the memoirs of John Sewell, Flagler's lead man in building the city, who wrote, quote, Mr. Ingraham, FEC Vice President for Lands and Development, was in the Miami section a few days after the Great Freeze in 1895 that killed practically all the citrus trees in Florida and killed coconut trees in Palm Beach, the phenomenon going down into the 20s. Mr. Ingraham found orange blossoms here on citrus trees that at that time were unhurt and carried a bunch of the orange blossoms to Mr. Flagler at Palm Beach. That made Mr. Flagler decide to build his railroad to Miami, as he said, where one orange tree would grow, with proper treatment, a thousand would grow, unquote. At first, Flagler was reluctant, but the lessons of the hard freeze were not lost on him. Following a trip to Biscayne Bay and Julia Tuttle in February of 1895, he agreed to bring the railroad to Biscayne Bay. In February 1896, after several months of delays clearing up land title questions, Flagler dispatched one of his top foremen to Biscayne Bay to clear land for the luxurious Royal Palm Hotel, which he planned to build. The man Flagler chose to clear the land, lay out the streets, and build his hotel was John Sewell of Kissimmee. Sewell was a labor superintendent for the Flagler system and worked on Flagler's projects in Palm Beach. When asked to go to Biscayne Bay with a work crew of his choosing to start a new city, Sewell handpicked groups consisting of 12 men, all black. These workers became Miami's first black residents. They were A.W. Brown, Philip Bowman, Jim Hawkins, Warren Merity, Richard Mangrum, Romeo Fashaw, Scipio Coleman, Sim Anderson, Davy Hartley, J.B. Brown, William Collier, and Joe Thompson. According to Miami historian Howard Klamberg, another man named Jim Clory was among the first black workers, but his name does not appear in Sewell's account. Sewell, his brother E.G. Sewell, and three white men, J.E. Loomis, C.T. McCrimmon, and T.L. Townley, departed with the 12-man work crew from Flagler's new Royal Ponciano Hotel in Palm Beach at 6 in the morning on March 3, 1896. Flagler himself bid them farewell at the train station. The men took the Flagler Railroad to Fort Lauderdale, at that time the end of the line. From there they took the steamer, Della, and at 5 o'clock that same afternoon, arrived at the lonely dock on Avenue D, which later became Miami Avenue. There was a compelling stillness in the darkening wilderness. There was nothing around them but woods. Sewell started by clearing the land for the site of the Royal Palm Hotel. Miami historians have skipped lightly over what happened to the Tecumseh Indian bones that were dug up to make room for the hotel. For thousands of years before the Spaniards reached Florida in 1513, the Tecumseh Indians had lived on Biscayne Bay, depending on the sea for their existence. A large village stood at the mouth of the Miami River. However, the Tecumseh, having no natural immunity to the many deadly diseases that the Spaniards brought with them, were virtually wiped out. When Spain finally ceded Florida to the United States in 1821, the few dozen remaining Tequesta left with the Spaniards for Cuba, where they became extinct. Workmen encountered a Tequesta burial mound, which probably had been in use for centuries at the site Flagler chose for the hotel. It was located at the mouth of the Miami River, now the parking lot in front of the DuPont Plaza Hotel in downtown Miami. The background of Figure 21 shows the mound, which stood between 25 and 75 feet high. Sewell ordered it leveled, and the black men shown in the historic photograph of the hotel's groundbreaking obliged him. Sewell recalls in his memoirs that as he leveled the burial mound, quote, "I began to find Indian skeletons, and altogether I took out between 50 and 60 skulls. I preserved all the bones and stored them away in barrels and gave away a great many of the skeletons to anyone who wanted them. Then stored the bones in my tool house for future reference, for they remained until the hotel was completed at the end of the year. As my tool house had to be torn down, I took about four of my most trusted Negroes and hauled all of these skeletons out nearby where there was a big hole in the ground, about 12 feet deep, and dumped the bones in it, then filled the hole with sand and instructed the Negroes to forget this burial and whereabouts of the same. And I suppose they did. There is a fine residence now standing over the bones, and the things that the owners don't know will never hurt them." Unquote. As word spread that there was work to be had on Biscayne Bay, dozens of black men soon camped in tents in the woods near the hotel. Clearing the streets was not at first a part of Sewell's job. His top priority was to clear the land for the Royal Palm Hotel. He was assigned the street cleaning task after the contractor who originally had the job failed miserably. The problem was trying to pry the roots of the tenacious trees from the coral rock in which they were spitefully deeply embedded. An even greater challenge to the land clearers was a thick swath of mangrove hammock on the bayfront where Bayside, the Intercontinental Hotel, and Bayfront Park stand today. The impenetrable mangroves grew as thick as a man's arm and never had been disturbed. When Sewell took over the job, the contractor who had extended the railroad to the city urged him to use the 150 white convicts who had been working on the railroad project. Sewell preferred to use his own men, but gave in and put the convicts to work clearing land for the streets. However, even they would not approach the bayfront hammock. After a few futile days, the convicts were moved out, and Sewell unleashed a work gang of 100 black men to annihilate the bayfront hammock, which they did. This is Sewell's account. "Finally, the convicts were moved, and I sent out word by all my Negroes that I wanted 100 Negro laborers next Monday morning to start street clearing. By that time, the railroad was completed and the woods were full of Negro laborers. When Monday morning came, there were 110 Negroes at my tool house waiting for me. I hit the hammock first, as that had been what everyone had been afraid of. And to tell you the truth, it did look like a terrible job clearing those big trees and brush and vines. I had provided myself with dynamite, bush hooks, and everything else needed. I went to work with my 100 Negroes without any other foreman on the work. I was determined to clear the streets and master the Miami Rock. When I cleared the Boulevard and Avenue B from 11th Street to 1st Street, I had my men work in a V-shape, the head men with bush hooks, the next row of men with axes, and the next row with grubbing hoes." Unquote. Sewell and his crew made headway, but were often stymied in the dense thicket by two types of trees. One was the formidable ironwood tree. True to its name, the tree was so hard that it would often break off the edge of an axe. Although Sewell's men would lose as many as a dozen axe blades in a day on these stubborn trees, they ultimately prevailed. The other problem was the poisonous tree, the name of which Sewell did not know. He was, however, very familiar with what it did to his men, wrote Sewell in his memoirs, quote, "I do not know its name. But when the bark was broken and one touched the sap of this, it would poison one, and even the fumes of this tree would poison, and the men would suffer untold agony. With some of them, their faces would swell so that one could not see their eyes. We would handle it like we would a rattlesnake and burn it as quickly as we could get it down and be careful not to touch where the bark was broken." Unquote. Taming the wilderness around Biscayne Bay proved to be a brutal job. Practically all the hard physical labor involved was done by blacks. Whites who were streaming into the new city were not coming to Miami to clear land or dig sewers. They were coming to get into business, to make a fast buck in the land boom, or to realize some other dream. Whites generally disdained the menial tasks, which they described as colored work. The view of one of Miami's earliest Jewish residents, Isidore Cohen, was probably typical. Cohen, who became one of the city's most successful businessmen, arrived in Miami in 1896 as Flagler's men were clearing the streets. Out of money and anxious to start a retail business with the stock he had brought, Cohen approached Julia Tuttle about quickly starting a store. She told him that the streets were not yet laid out and suggested that he hire himself out to help clear the land for the city's streets. Cohen recorded the conversation with Tuttle in his diary. Quote, "Had an interview with Mrs. Tuttle, who is said to be the owner of the North Side Territory, in regard to renting a piece of ground for the erection of a store building. Results very disappointing. Must wait until land is clear and streets laid out, when lots will be put up for sale. On declaring that I could not wait owing to my destitute condition, I was told to take a job clearing land, whereupon I tried to impress this naive lady that the last labor of that character my race had performed was in the land of Egypt, and that it would be a violation of my religious convictions to assume that condition of servitude." Unquote. Thus, the grueling and dangerous work of breaking the stubborn land fell primarily to blacks, who now streamed into the Bay Area looking for work. The birth of Miami and Colored Town, 1896-1926. In June 1896, John Sewell's superiors in the Flagler organization told him that there were probably enough people living in the area to incorporate a city. Sewell was asked to make an estimate of exactly how many people lived on the shores of the bay at that time. He later wrote in his memoirs, quote, "I made the survey going to each shack or tent and boarding house, making inquiry as to how many people lived at each place. When I got through and checked up, we had 3,000 people, men, women, and children, white and black." Unquote. As the city of Miami came to life, blacks living on the bay had no political power, recognition, or influence. However, they were present at the incorporation meeting for the establishment of the city on July 28, 1896. 4 days before the city of Miami was incorporated, the Miami Metropolis reported that there were 438 registered male voters in the precinct, of which 182, or 41.5%, were black. Essentially, the blacks were pawns of the Flagler interest in establishing and later controlling the city. State law required a minimum number of registered voters to incorporate a city. So, in order to meet the minimum, Flagler's supervisors got their black workers to attend the incorporation meeting. Therefore, of the 367 voters who incorporated the city, 162 were black. All those who voted were men, since women were disenfranchised at that time. The first name on the chart of the city of Miami is that of Silas Austin, a black man. At one time, it was believed that W.H. Artson, another black man, was the first name on the charter. A closer examination of the minutes of the incorporation meeting, however, revealed that although Artson was first in the list of eligible voters, he was not present at the meeting. Although blacks were manipulated in the process of establishing the city, they were not entirely silent at the meeting. Isidore Cohen's recollection of the event was that a, quote, "darky named Lightburn," unquote, delivered the best speech. The man Cohen referred to was Alex C. Lightburn, who was born in England of the Bahamas in October of 1852. In addition to establishing himself as a vocal founder of the city, Lightburn held the organization meeting of the Greater Bethel AME Church in his home 4 months later. 3 years after the incorporation of the city of Miami, the black vote was needed again, this time to move the county seat from Juneau to Miami. During this period, the boundary of Dade County stretched through what is now Broward and Palm Beach counties. The final countywide vote was 690-468 in favor of moving the county seat to Miami. The black vote was a strong factor in this decision. Miami's electorate cast 404 votes in this election. 398 were in support of Miami as county seat. The Miami Metropolis openly acknowledged the importance of the black vote in the southern half of Dade County. Quote, "Everything went smooth from morning until night, and all worked in harmony for the general good. And for once the color line was obliterated, and every one of the black and tan vote counted. White men were riding through the streets with the colored fellows, and there was full determination that the colored fellows should vote just as he wished, which fortunately was for Miami." Unquote. The first Florida East Coast Railroad passenger train roared into Miami with its big bell clanging and its whistle wide open at about 9 o'clock on the evening of April 12, 1896. The station was located opposite the black section. More than 300 people turned out to mark the historic event. The city of Miami was open for business. Julia Tuttle did not live to see the city she had dreamed of come into its own. She died suddenly on September 14, 1898, at the relatively young age of 48. Life in early Miami centered around the grandiose Royal Palm Hotel. Like all Flagler hotels from St. Augustine to Miami, the hotel was constructed of wood and painted yellow with green trim. Built at a cost of $750,000 on land donated to Flagler by Julia Tuttle, the hotel was capable of serving 600 guests. The white business community expanded rapidly during the boom period between 1896 and 1926. The principal business street was Avenue D, now known as Miami Avenue. The other main thoroughfare was 12th Street, now called Flagler Street. Of course, blacks were not allowed to operate businesses along these streets. Many of these early businesses burned down in a raging fire on Christmas night in 1896. After another devastating blaze on November 12, 1899, the vulnerable wooden buildings were no longer an acceptable risk, and the city rebuilt itself in bricks. Buildings in Colored Town, the black settlement across the railroad tracks, remained wooden and dangerous. The boom was ended suddenly by the Great Hurricane of 1926, which made a direct hit on downtown Miami. Although it survived the storm, the Royal Palm Hotel was among the ultimate casualties as the building boom ended and the city's future became a matter of great concern. Declared a fire hazard, the hotel was torn down in 1930. According to the census of 1900, the black population of Miami at the turn of the century was 966, approximately 722 of whom were born in the United States and 212 born in the Bahamas. Of course, many Bahamians came to South Florida as seasonal agricultural workers and were not counted in the census. Conditions in the teeming black quarter grew worse as the population became denser. Handicapped by the lack of even basic city services, Colored Town was a squalid, congested district characterized by unpaved streets lined with rickety houses and shacks. Fire was a constant threat. The lack of adequate sanitation facilities caused chronic epidemics of influenza, yellow fever, and even smallpox. Blacks, politically impotent, could do little to improve their situation. Some black Miami pioneers believe that the arrival of the railroad actually worsened conditions for blacks. Dr. Samuel Hinsdale Johnson, a black man whose parents were early arrivals from the Bahamas, said, quote, "In the early days, Miami was a small town. Everybody knew everybody, whites and blacks. Sunday afternoons were for boat trips to Ocean Beach, Miami Beach, for picnics and baseball games. As the town developed, however, the lines were drawn fast. We became hemmed in. Miami really became a hellhole after the railroad arrived and Carl Fisher developed Miami Beach," unquote. Johnson became Miami's first black radiologist. As a child growing up in a city only 7 years older than himself, Johnson was a witness to Miami's development during a critical stage in the city's history. He recalled that in the early days, whites allowed blacks to use Miami Beach, then called Ocean Beach. There were no people living on Miami Beach at that time, and beachgoers, white and black, traveled to Ocean Beach by boat. It was not until some time later that whites stopped blacks from using the public beach. When the rail link between Palm Beach and Miami was completed, much of the workforce hired on with the grandiose Overseas Railroad project. Built from Homestead to Key West between 1904 and 1912, the Overseas Railroad was described by the hard-boiled Flagler as the toughest job he ever undertook. Good laborers were in demand across the country. The labor supply relied upon to build the Panama Canal was not available to Flagler, and the law provided that labor could not be imported from the Caribbean. Thus, black workers from the Bahamas, Cuba, and Jamaica could not be used. Flagler resorted to hiring foreign workers, particularly Germans and Italians, who were arriving in the North by the thousands, anxious to improve their lot. Most were recruited in New York and shipped to Miami for work on the extension. The intense recruiting effort did bring in some black workers, and by December 1905, the Flagler organization had set up separate camps for Italian, German, Greek, and black laborers. The Miami Evening Record, now defunct, reported that the Flagler organization used these workers differently. The most grueling labor was reserved for black workers. An executive committee of the organization, headed by Flagler himself, reported that blacks, being accustomed to the use of the axe, did all the rough work of clearing and that white laborers followed to do the grading. By July 1906, the Flagler organization, having secured sufficient foreign workers, summarily fired many of its black extension workers. The Daily Miami Metropolis reported in a reprint from the Fort Pierce News, quote, "The FEC Railroad is about to dispense with nearly all of its colored section hands, having made arrangements to hire 800 Italians along the line in the near future. 50 are en route from Eden and other points. The Sicilians they formerly tried proved too dull, but they have secured a more intelligent set of men now. The colored men seem rather too independent for that class of work, which requires a man to be constantly on the job. But the Dago can be counted on the day after payday as certainly as any other time, although it is admitted that he will not do as much work in a given time as a black man, but will achieve more in time owing to his presence at all times." Unquote. In May 1907, despite the destruction wrought by the severe hurricane of October 1906, the completed railroad reached Key Largo, marking the end of the first phase of the extension. Complaints from Miamians about the presence of so many foreign immigrants declined as the center of construction activity shifted from the Florida mainland towards Key West. The line reached Key West in 1912. The project's completion was rightfully hailed as Flagler's crowning achievement, a modern-day miracle. But the price was high. By 1912, hundreds had perished in hurricanes and construction accidents. The rails themselves were soon washed away and destroyed by the great key storms of the 20s and 30s. The present-day overseas highway was built on the nearly destroyed railroad tracks and bridges. Flagler died in 1913 at the age of 83. The first newspaper in the city of Miami was the Miami Metropolis, founded in 1896 before the incorporation of the city. From its inception, the Miami Metropolis had an ambiguous editorial policy towards blacks. Sometimes it espoused a sympathetic, although paternalistic, attitude. The newspaper, however, also supported severe punishment for recalcitrant blacks. Indeed, the Miami Metropolis was not beyond advocating lynching of blacks. For example, in 1897, when the city was barely a year old, the Metropolis carried a story about a riot in Key West. Savannah Johnson, a 19-year-old black man, allegedly raped a white woman as she was gathering flowers with three of her friends. She identified Johnson, and he was jailed. That night, a mob gathered to lynch Johnson, but failed because the jailkeeper would not cooperate. Blacks in Key West were outraged. When a mob tried a second time to lynch Johnson, the sheriff and an armed posse of black citizens thwarted the effort, but a white man was killed as he approached the jail. The Miami Metropolis noted that the racial trouble had been caused by C.B. Pendleton, the white editor of two Key West newspapers, who had asked on his editorial pages if there were not enough white men present to lynch Johnson. Quote, "The Metropolis reported on July 2, 1897, that this statement warned blacks of a possible lynching, giving them time to organize themselves to prevent it." Quote, "If Pendleton had remained silent," the Metropolis mused, "and a quiet meeting had been held in secret and arrangements perfected for a necktie party, it might have been accomplished with very little excitement." Unquote. The newspaper then asked for a military company or naval reserve unit to preserve order in case a similar incident occurred in Miami. Quote, "There is no telling at what moment some fiendish act similar to that perpetrated in Key West last week may occur in this city or vicinity and precipitate a race war." Unquote. Blacks were often the subject of degrading humor on the pages of the Miami Metropolis, where they were described as shiftless and unintelligent people who loved to sing and dance. The Metropolis, when covering the popular blackface minstrel shows, commented on how well whites portrayed blacks. Quote, Atkinson, in our opinion, made the most natural-looking nigger. And a lady in our hearing said he reminded her of an old darky who used to live on the farm where she was brought up in Georgia. His face was perfectly blank. The evidence of intelligence was conspicuous by its absence, unquote. The article also mentioned that a man, quote, named Moran made a nice chubby nigger, and his well-fed appearance indicated that he was raised in a section where hog and hominy are abundant, unquote. On another occasion, the Miami Metropolis related a story about, quote, an unnamed black prisoner held for petty larceny who escaped from the county jail while emptying slop buckets. The Metropolis reported, quote, in his flight, he came across a running deer and yelled for it to get out of his way as he was coming and could not wait, unquote. The Miami Metropolis and later the Miami Herald regularly referred to blacks with such characterizations as darky, coon, fiend, hamfat, often running racially degrading stories. One article discussing the need to rid the city of those blacks who were seen as loafers, the Metropolis noted that a certain Mr. Savage, a white man, had helped, quote, clean out the town of the hamfat, as the loafing, gambling Negroes are called, unquote. Lemon City and Hardyville, 1896 to 1926. Many blacks lived and worked in Lemon City prior to the establishment of the city of Miami. This area continued to grow as the city of Miami to the south was taking its first faltering steps. When the Hearst starch mill began to operate in 1910 in Lemon City, it created a large and steady demand for company routes. Most of the diggers were black men and were paid $2 to $3 a ton. Other black men in Lemon City worked in the area's tomato fields and citrus groves, while black women usually did domestic work for well-to-do whites. By 1900, the black community of Lemon City was divided into at least three sections called Nazarene, Knightsville, and Bowstown. According to an old plat book, Nazarene was bounded by Northeast 71st Street to the north, Northeast 3rd Avenue to the east, and Northeast 2nd Avenue to the west. The south boundary was never determined. Nazarene was part pine land and part prairie, including a muddy low-lying area called a slough. Nazarene was officially platted by a white man named Lewis W. Pierce in 1900. No records explain why Pierce selected this name, and even the present-day residents don't know the origin of the name. Most believe it has something to do with the biblical city of Nazareth. Others say that an old Nazarene church used to be located in the area, and Pierce took the name from the church. Referred to as Commodore because he owned three boats, Pierce also owned large chunks of Lemon City and needed an area in which to house the blacks who worked his crops. Knightsville occupied only 5 acres. The tiny community consisted of small lots on pine land reaching west up the ridge from Northeast 2nd Avenue at 68th Street on opposite sides of a sand road scarcely 2 blocks long, which ended near a rock pit. Knightsville was the cultural center of Black Lemon City. On the north side of the sand road were 2 churches, St. James AME Methodist Church near 2nd Avenue and Mount Tabor Baptist Church, a block west on the same side of the road at the crest of the ridge. Almost opposite St. James was the Oddfellows Lodge, a 2-story wood frame building. The lower story was used for a school and the upper story for lodge meetings as well as social events. The Baptists and Methodists used the hall on alternate Sundays. The good relationship between the 2 churches continued after they moved west to Liberty City around 1920, where both survive today. The other black settlement in Lemon City was Bowstown, named for Elijah Bowles, a black man. He and his wife Rosa came to Lemon City from Lake City, Florida. Bowstown was near or just west of present-day Miami Avenue at about 57th Street. Before 1915, there were no access roads to Bowstown, other than sand roads through the pine trees. The land had been part of the Ada Merritt homestead. Bowles, who brought the property, built a number of shacks along a single street, and ran a small store. From the rents he collected and the profits of his store, he became one of the most affluent blacks in Lemon City. Early black settlers in Nazarene included members of the Barnes family. Clarence W. Barnes was born in Charleston, South Carolina, and moved to San Mateo, Florida before the Great Freeze. There he married a woman named Lucy Long. San Mateo was an important citrus area, and Barnes worked as a farm laborer before moving to Lemon City in 1897. At first, the Barneses lived in a small house on the property of B.C. DuPont at Northeast 70th Street near 2nd Avenue. When the area was subdivided, Barnes bought three lots, two of them facing DuPont Road, now called Northeast 71st Street. On one lot, the family ran a tiny store selling grits, canned milk, and other staples. Barnes made a simple ice box using sawdust as insulation. He buried ice blocks in the sawdust and chipped off pieces as they were needed to cool drinks. Barnes worked as a farm laborer on nearby farms, including one at Cracker Flats, as the blacks called the prairie just west of Little River. Typical of the black lifestyle of the period, the Barnes house was split by a breezeway with two rooms on each side. They cooked on a wood stove, used kerosene lamps and lanterns, and boiled clothes in a wash pot in the yard. The family grew a few guavas and always had a garden with plenty of okra and cabbage. They kept chickens and owned a horse, which was unusual for a black family in those days. Another of the early black families in Lemon City was the Ford family. They lived in Niceville near Mount Tabor Baptist Church. Maxie Ford, who died in 1956 at the age of 84, was a farmer who came from San Mateo. His wife was the former Isabel Bowles, sister of the founder of Bowlestown, Elijah Bowles. Their daughter, Charlotte Ford, became principal of Douglas Elementary and Drew Elementary Schools and a leading figure in Dade County education when black students were segregated into their own schools. Quote, "My parents brought me here from San Mateo when I was an infant in 1905. First, we lived on the bayfront. Negroes and white were living together. Can you believe that? My father, Maxie Ford, was the greatest tomato farmer in the world. The biggest house was owned by the Reverend B.F. Goodwin. It was an ostentatious place. I remember it burned down one day, and I'll always remember how sad I was watching that grand place burn down." Unquote. Charlotte Ford died in 1991. Horace S. Sharp married another Bowles sister, Rosa. They had a home in an old store near Bowlestown where another legendary figure of Dade County black education, Isabel Sharp Blue, was born. Blue served as principal of George Washington Carver Elementary School in Coconut Grove for many years. Interviewed long after her retirement, she remembered a grove of old lemon trees where she played as a child in Lemon City. Lemon City was swallowed up by the northern edge of Miami in the early 1900s. Houses and business supply companies replaced most of the black residential areas of Lemon City. While the old wooden houses of Nazarene have little value, the land on which they stand is increasing in value in the growing industrial area. Lots in the area are now valued between $20,000 and $50,000, depending on the size. As late as 1980, however, eight old black residents remained in yellow and gray washed wooden houses in an area that they called Nazaree. Miami's first red light district was known as Hardyville. As the city of Miami grew, efforts were made to respect Julia Tuttle's wish that saloons and brothels not be allowed to operate within the city limits. The northwest area of Colortown became the center of gambling, prostitution, a considerable amount of which involved white men hiring black prostitutes, and general rowdiness. Some of the drinking and gambling establishments were within 20 feet of the city boundary. The district was dubbed Hardyville after Dade County Sheriff Dan Hardy, who created Hardyville by herding all the prostitutes from North Miami into the area after the respectable citizens of North Miami requested that he help clean up the community. The area drew the uninvited attentions of the white establishment, including influential white women who may have had more to do with its demise than did their husbands. Dr. James Jackson, after whom Jackson Memorial Hospital is named, was among several prominent citizens at a town meeting in October of 1912, urging an end to all vice. Jackson said that entirely too many white men contracted venereal diseases from Harterville prostitutes and then infected their wives. The meeting sparked the formation of the Civic League of Miami, an organization dedicated to the improvement of morals. Ultimately, the Civic League was very successful in temporarily reducing vice in Colortown. Their success prompted local black leaders to organize their own group called the Civic League of Colortown. Among their demands were imposing an 8 p.m. curfew on children, removing all immoral women from the streets, and prohibiting, quote, good women, unquote, from going all over town unescorted after 9 p.m. Black South Dade communities, circa 1900. In the early 1900s, the population of Dade County was expanding rapidly along the tracks of the Florida East Coast Railroad as Flagler's rails left Miami and plunged southward towards the sea. The warm climate and fertile soil of South Florida attracted many farmers, particularly from Georgia, South Carolina, and North and Central Florida. The increase in the permanent black population of South Dade County around the turn of the century was in large measure due to blacks having followed migrating white farmers in the aftermath of the Great Freeze. By 1900, several black settlements were developing in South Dade County, including Larkins, later called South Miami, Homestead, Perrine, and Florida City. The first black man to buy land in Larkins was Marshall Williamson. Born in Madison, Florida on January 31, 1890, he graduated from Georgia State College, where he learned carpentry, a trade he followed all his life. Williamson came to Larkins in 1912 and bought land. At one time, he owned the land from Southwest 64th to Southwest 66th Streets, from 62nd to 65th Avenues. Before he even finished building his house at 6500 Southwest 60th Avenue, church services and classes for school children were being held there. In 1916, Williamson donated the land for St. James AME Church, the first church for blacks in South Miami. He also donated the land for J.R.E. Lee School on Southwest 62nd Avenue. In 1900, black and white settlers homesteaded the high, dry land around the area now known as Gould's. A man named William Johnson, about whom nothing is known except that he was black, filed on a quarter section, later bisected diagonally by the railroad, extending from what is now Southwest 216th Street to beyond 224th Street. It included all the land that later became downtown Gould's. D.D. Gale, another black man, later purchased the northwest section of Johnson's homestead and built rental housing, a restaurant, and a large packing house along Dixie Highway south of 220th Street. The town of Gould's, also called Black Point, was started with the arrival of the Far East Coast Railroad in 1903. A man named Gould, who was in charge of cutting ties for the railroad, operated a siding below Southwest 216th Street. The town that grew up there was originally called Gould's Siding, and later just Gould's. Gould's had an early reputation as a rough place. By some accounts, the flag organization recruited drifters and convicts from North Florida for the labor force there. Prisoners were released to the company to work out their sentences and then turned loose when they finished. These accounts may or may not have been true. Nonetheless, Gould's was a rough, tough place with open saloons, killings, and fights as the usual weekend fare. Gould's became the center of the packing house industry, bringing in hundreds of fruit tramps during the season. The old Dixie Highway was lined with packing houses, which have since been razed by fires, tornadoes, and hurricanes. Among the notable early black settlers in Gould's were Gus Bowles, thought to be the richest black man in the community, Jasper Harrington, who worked on the Florida East Coast Railroad from Jacksonville to Miami, Tara Rowe and Arthur and Polly Mays, who opened the only medical facility, and Johnny Catman Everett, who was an avid hunter of wildcats, an animal doctor of sorts, and all-around medicine man. The homemade remedies that Everett prescribed included 9 drops of warm turtle blood for whooping cough, rattlesnake oil for arthritis, and cooked rattlesnake for tuberculosis. He treated gonorrhea with shots of potassium permanganate, which he administered in his barn. Early racial incidents. Miami has always had racial conflict, much of it quite bloody. Blacks were usually the victims, but they never accepted their victimization quietly. The city was barely 2 years old when it experienced its first serious racial incident. On June 20, 1898, during the Spanish-American War, General Theodore M. Swann received orders to move his division of Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas volunteers to Miami. The Army built a camp called Camp Miami, which housed about 7,500 white soldiers adjacent to Colored Town. Only about 2,000 people lived in Miami at the time. Choosing to disregard the staggering problems that such an influx of people was certain to create, the town's small but enterprising merchant community welcomed the infusion of much-needed capital. Henry Flagler jumped on the bandwagon, lending his wholehearted support to welcoming the troops to Miami. The Miami metropolis could hardly contain its enthusiasm, cheerily reporting on June 24, 1898, quote, "Under the efficient management of the officials of the East Coast Railroad, Camp Miami has been made the most beautiful and convenient camp for soldiers in the state," unquote. Every unbiased account suggests otherwise. The plan for the camp was well conceived but not followed. Four of the regiments found themselves beyond the city's sewer lines and resorted to a crude bucket system, which was blamed for the high incidence of typhoid fever. When troops used surface wells rather than the water piped into the city, in violation of all health standards, they paid a high price in disease. The men were unhappy from the first. The drill field was a mile away. The city offered little that was attractive to the men, who described Miami as a luxury hotel and a wilderness. Camp Miami was rowdy and poorly disciplined. It was overcrowded. The men were hot and bored. Many of them spent their time swimming naked, shooting at coconuts, and directing pranks at the indignant civilian community. Such improprieties were patiently laughed off by the merchants and other community leaders who eagerly anticipated the arrival of monthly pay allotments. Harmless fun became vicious and deadly in July of 1898 when, according to eyewitnesses, soldiers of Texas Company L were outraged at the refusal of a black man to stand aside for two white women approaching him on a sidewalk. Assaulted and beaten, the man narrowly averted being lynched. He was saved by the arrival of officers who restored order. That evening, soldiers from Company L marched into the black section of Miami, shooting out every kerosene lamp found burning. This resulted in the flight of many blacks to Coconut Grove, ending only after city representatives promised full protection for the blacks to go to work the next morning. Miami pioneer J.K. Dorn confirmed that the quick response was prompted by economics. Quote, "Without black labor, white Miamians found it difficult to operate their restaurants, hotels, and stores," unquote. Racial unrest continued between the camp and blacks, culminating in an incident on July 23, 1898. Private Virgil H. Duncan of Company M, 1st Texas Regiment, killed a black cook named Sam Brummer when Brummer brushed against a white woman in a narrow aisle. Duncan stalked and shot Brummer in broad daylight, but he was exonerated by a Miami coroner's jury that ruled Brummer's death was caused by an unknown person or persons. The military then court-martialed Duncan, but he was acquitted without explanation and returned to active duty. At no time in the brief history of Camp Miami was any soldier arrested. Only the end of the Spanish-American War and the evacuation of the camp in August of 1898 averted additional violence. 5 years later, the city was again facing a serious race problem. In March 1903, a white woman named Rose Gould allegedly was raped by a black man identified as Richard Deadwillie. Stunned by the assault, the Miami metropolis appealed to racial passion by suggesting that lynch law might be applied to the perpetrator once he was located. In a race-baiting article entitled, quote, "Fiendish Black Brute Brings Home to Us the Question of What Can Be Done with These Black Sons of Hell," unquote, the Miami metropolis expounded on its theory of race relations. Quote, "All kinds of remedies have been resorted to, including hemp, tar, and torch, and yet it seems it is all of no avail. And occasionally, the demon in human form breaks loose, fearing neither God nor man, bent upon the commission of a crime worse than the foulest murder. For such beings, no punishment is meet. No wonder that lynchings and roastings are resorted to, and such things will continue to take place, north and south, east and west, as long as these devilish attempts upon the virtue and lives of white women are made. If white men of Miami had gotten their hands upon him, they would have made short work of putting out his worst and worthless life." Unquote. Although DeWillie was arrested on rape charges, many white Miamians were enraged by the crime and demanded immediate justice. There was even talk of an assault by whites on Colored Town. Reflecting the rage of white Miami, the Miami Metropolis reported the capture of the, quote, unholy fiend of hell, unquote, and then added, almost hopefully, that Miamians planned to treat him to a necktie party. As it turned out, the punishment meted out by the court was just as swift. After a 15-minute trial, DeWillie was hanged in the yard of the county jail within the same month that the crime was committed. Public access to the hanging of DeWillie was denied, but in June 1906, about 200 Miamians were allowed to witness the hanging of Ed Brown, a black man who had been convicted of murdering a white woman. 2 years after the DeWillie incident, Miami again was on the brink of racial violence. In January 1905, C.E. Davis, a white man, and his two daughters were murdered while they slept. It was determined that one of the girls had been sexually assaulted. Naturally, police investigators turned to Colored Town to find the murderer or murderers. Two black men were arrested, but they were later released when a grand jury found insufficient evidence to proceed against them.